Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Listeners do support the Peter B. Collins Show, and I'm grateful to Carol Pridgen of Blue Lake, California, and Keita Tom of Corvallis, Oregon. Thanks for your support. If you'd like to help, you can subscribe voluntarily for as little as $5 a month. The info is at peterbcollins.com.
Tonight there's gonna be a jailbreak somewhere in this town. See, me and the boys, we don't like it, so we're getting up and going down. Hide low, looking right to left. If you see us coming, I think it's best to move away. Do you hear what I say from under my breath?
Tonight is gonna be a jailbreak somewhere in the town. Tonight is gonna be a jailbreak, so won't you be around?
Andy Worthington returns to our program today, the British author and journalist who is an expert on Guantanamo Bay and those who have been imprisoned there. Andy just completed a brief tour of the United States to screen his documentary, Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. And I caught up with him in Berkeley about a week ago and acquired a signed copy of his book, The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. And Andy, it was a real pleasure to meet you. Thank you for taking the time and trouble to come to the States and share your documentary and try to reach out to people about the issues related to Guantanamo.
Well, thanks, Peter. It was, on the social level, it was a real pleasure to, to meet up with several people, actually, like yourself, who I'd been in communication with by email on the phone, but had never met in person. So, I admit that was one side of it that attracted me to coming over. But, you know, my more serious motive, obviously, was to try and talk about some of the still unresolved issues. And, 10 months into the Obama administration, I actually think that I was surprised at how difficult it is in general to deal with the some of the thorny questions that still remain at Guantanamo, partly because a significant number of people seem to think Obama came in and waved a magic wand and everything's been sorted out. And I think, actually, funnily enough, what happened towards the end of my trip when the charges were put forward for various prisoners in Guantanamo will be the start of a process of people, certainly some people, becoming aware that actually closing the prison is not going to be as easy as President Obama made it out to be at the start of the year.
Indeed. And I want to address those issues in a moment. The first thing I wanted to ask you about was response on the overall tour, because, frankly, I was disappointed that there weren't more people who came to your appearance in Berkeley that I attended, and that those who did are really part of the hardcore anti-Iraq war movement who, opposed the Bush administration. And my point is not that, here is my point. I'll just put it this way, that I'm disappointed that there aren't more Americans who are concerned about these issues and recognizing the damage that continues to be done to our perception and our status in the world by our embrace of these barbaric practices, which are symbolized by Guantanamo. And I do applaud the administration's effort to end it, but my disappointment is that most Americans don't seem to care about it.
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, I think you have a very valid point, Peter, because, you know, I noticed this in other places that I visited as well. I mean, I think this was true in New York. And early on, I don't know whether somebody gave me this phrase or whether I came up with it, but you know, the Obama effect. And I just mentioned briefly that, you know, there certainly has been a lot of feeling that, you know, this issue has been sorted out and that the Americans don't need to think about it anymore, and that President Obama made it possible for Americans to feel good about themselves again. You know, and I think symbolically, President Obama certainly did do something to make Americans feel better about themselves. But the nitty-gritty of details, of course, is much more complex than that. And I think the lack of interest is partly to do with the slow process of Obama's supporters and people generally, you know, from the center to the left, coming to terms with either, you know, what has been achieved, what's extremely difficult to achieve because of problems within the U.S. political system and how difficult it is to affect any kind of meaningful change, and that's the problems with Congress. You know, but also certainly confusions within the Democratic Party, and that you know, they don't always present a clear message. They seem often to be confused on issues, and I think certainly on issues relating to Guantanamo and clearing up what Obama once referred to as the mess that he inherited from the Bush administration. Not only a certain amount of dithering, but actually a lack of courage at certain key moments, which has made the job much more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So it really felt like it was a time of a certain amount of confusion, really, you know, with some people coming to terms with disappointments and other people not yet realizing. And I think the activists that you're referring to are the people, you know, who were complaining to me that it wasn't possible, really, to... felt like they were starting from scratch, even with things like the anti-war movement, where there'd been a huge impetus.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you know, it's not as though America suddenly became demilitarized as soon as Obama came into power. And the question of Afghanistan is very much, very much there. And yet, you know, they found it as though they're, you know, almost starting again, trying to get people out to protest about stuff.
Well, and Andy, as we delve into these recent developments, for example, the decision by the Attorney General Eric Holder to charge five, including the well-known Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the five people alleged to have been involved in the 9/11 plots, they're going to be tried in New York City in federal court. And I do support and applaud that decision. But what's interesting in the dialogue and the debate and the pushback that surfaces from that is that so many Americans take Guantanamo as a status quo, and that the idea of bringing these individuals to the United States, they seem to be allergic to the idea that they would come onto our territory, and that we can't confine them, contain them, and you know, maintain security. And they come up with all these kind of fraudulent arguments, but at the base of them is this premise that it's okay to hold these people uncharged on an unlimited basis at Guantanamo, and that it hurts us to introduce them to our criminal justice system. So that kind of fundamental premise, which I think, you know, is in some ways framed by our media, and also the way Americans tend to conflate Hollywood movies and video games with reality.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe that's a very good point, actually, Peter. But, I mean, you know, I think at a rather distressing level, it demonstrates how fundamentally, you know, the approach to serious crimes, and let's put this in the context that I believe that it was, that this wasn't a prelude to a war. This was a criminal act that took place on September 11, 2001. And that the confusion of that with a war, an act of war, has really was the base of all the confusions that we've seen since. And there's just been a shift in mentality which was affected extremely well by the Bush administration when they first began their mission to declare that everybody at Guantanamo was the worst of the worst, even though, you know, horribly, the horrible truth is that they had less idea about who the majority of those people were than almost anybody who had ever been in U.S. custody before. So the gap between the rhetoric and the truth is a chasm.
And also the corporate media in this country has not made any effort whatsoever to disabuse people of the notion advanced by Bush and Cheney that only the worst of the worst went to Guantanamo, and if you're there, you are de facto guilty. And we don't need to bother with a trial and with the, you know, judicial system and processes, that it's all just so cut and dried. And what your book and your work has so deftly pointed out, Andy, is that most of the people who went to Guantanamo had no connection whatsoever to Al-Qaeda, to 9/11, to Osama bin Laden, and that they were people who were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong look and the wrong surname, and they became fodder for our bounty program. And so we bought and paid for a lot of innocent people, who many of whom spent 3 to 5 years in this gulag at Guantanamo. And Americans seem to, you know, many of them are ignorant of it, but they don't seem to care or want to find out those details. They simply accept the offerings of Bush and Cheney that these are the bad guys and you don't even want to know about them.
Well, sure, you know, and I mean, I had one interesting exchange, actually, when, I went and did an event in Fairfax, Virginia, and I stayed in a hotel that evening. And, I was doing some writing late in my room, so I went down to the foyer and got a coffee. And there was a young guy who served me there, and, you know, we got chatting, and I told him what I worked on. And, he just looked at me quizzically and said, so is it right that all these guys are terrorists? You know, and then what he was asking, I could see that he thought, I think I've been oversold a story here, but he didn't have the facts at his fingertips, as you're saying. I mean, you have to go looking for the truth. And I mean, part of the story of how it's been told or how it's not been told adequately by the mainstream media, a lot of it is that on the one hand, of course, you have, you know, hysterical right-wing broadcasters who, from my way of looking at things, shouldn't even be allowed to broadcast. Because, seriously.
Would we could impose your good taste on American media?
Has such an obsession with objectivity, Peter, that it's very hard often to perceive whether there is a message there. And I don't believe that that's justifiable. I think that objectivity is ringing the Pentagon and seeing if they've either say something or no comment, not constantly framing news reports as though there's some middle point in between the two points of view,
right?
And that an astute reader will be able to figure out what that is, because I think it just neuters it. And it's important to me, and I think a lot of people who are now writing online, that I think essentially, in an American journalistic sense, what I do is that I mix up news and op-ed. I write news stories with opinion, and because I think that that's actually an important thing to do, because there is no actually such a thing as objectivity.
Well,
what
and
it tends to do,
yes,
is to play into, it plays into not really criticizing things as much as should be a lot of the time.
Well, and many of these same strident right-wing voices talk about, you know, the need for a moral compass, for values, and those sorts of things. And when we look at Guantanamo, this is not on the one hand and on the other hand. This is all on one hand. It's illegal. It's unconstitutional. It conflicts with treaties that have been longstanding and that the U.S. championed. And it relies on fiction. The fiction that Guantanamo, because it's this little bit of land leased from Cuba, is not part of the United States, and therefore, the people held there would have no access to our court system. Well, that fiction has been overturned by the Republican-packed Supreme Court in this country.
Sure.
And so so much of it is frankly just bullshit that is used to advance a political agenda and a police state mentality that is wrapped in fear-mongering and this phony notion that violating laws and treaties and values is a way to keep us safe.
Yeah, well, no, absolutely. And, you know, and I think what's been particularly disappointing this last year is that although the Obama administration started off very well with, you know, with these executive orders ordering the closure of Guantanamo and upholding the absolute ban on torture and indicating that all prisoners seized in a military situation would be treated humanely, rescinding a lot of Bush's executive orders and memoranda, they didn't follow up. They did virtually nothing after that on these issues. Mm-hmm. And into that vacuum stepped this fear-mongering machine. And, I mean, it seems to me pretty clear that this is enormously cynical on the part of almost everybody who's involved in it, who starts wailing about how dangerous it would be.
Yes, sir.
To bring people to a country with, you know, the most fortified prisons on earth that nobody escapes from, with a long history of prosecuting dangerous people in federal courts, and even from the point of view of the rest of the world, you know, reveling in the punishment that can be dealt out to these people, you know, and having the death penalty in cases when, you know, most of the rest of the West doesn't do it anymore. I mean, you have a grand tradition of dealing authoritatively with this kind of thing, which really ought to be something that pleases right-wingers. And yet, on this topic, you know, it seems to me that there's an enormous amount of hypocrisy going on, actually.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just selling a message of fear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't actually mean it. They're scoring points against Obama. They decided back in spring that this was an easy win.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose it's at that point, Peter, that it becomes rather desperate to look at the imbalance in the media and to think, why is it not possible to have a kind of screaming left-wing news station that could just be, you know, doing back to Fox from the other side what they get away with without really having any competition? And in a way, I think that's a reflection of U.S. politics as a whole, that the Democrats are not very good at going out and shouting.
Well, they're cowards in the face of the fear card. And going back to what you were talking about a moment ago about the cracks that surfaced in April, there are some similarities here that Obama came in and grandstanded on day two with this flourish, the announcement that we're going to close Guantanamo and we're not going to torture anymore. And it strikes me as very similar to what Bill Clinton did on day one, trying to lift the ban on gays in the military.
Right.
And in both cases, these new presidents with limited experience in Washington, in Clinton's case, no experience in Washington, came in and thought that they had a mandate and that they had adequate public support. But what they didn't count on was resistance from members of their own party. When the Democrats joined with Republicans in April and May and stripped out funding to close Guantanamo, that was a clear sign that Obama had not properly vetted his decision with members of his own party and that they felt free to revolt and to join Republicans in challenging the new president on this, what he was trying to make a signature issue.
No, absolutely. And I mean, I think you're very right to pinpoint that particular time as one where, you know, he was really sold out by his own party and that they you know, that particular time has made what followed extremely difficult. I mean, you know, I don't want to take all the responsibility for this away from Obama because, you know, as I say, that I think there were other mistakes that were made. But he's certainly been up against it to an extraordinary degree. And, you know, I remember at the time Harry Reid talking about, you know, why they'd not been able to support Obama's plans. And it was ridiculous the way that he was parroting the terrorist rhetoric. I mean, you know,
mm-hmm.
What can you do when your own, you know, head representative amongst the lawmakers is just not getting on board? I mean, it was ridiculous.
Now, the Obama administration has, here in mid-November, affirmed our suspicions, which are that they will not be able to close Guantanamo by the end of January, upcoming January 2010. Now, I'm not surprised by that because of what we just touched on and that I don't think that Obama understood the disarray at Guantanamo, the fact that the files on the prisoners there were incomplete and in many cases seemed to be kind of scattered around different places. I made a comment to you in Berkeley last week that your book is more organized and has more details, more dossier information on those held at Guantanamo than it appears the official records that they had there.
I think it's probably definitely all in one place, whereas who knows where theirs was, scattered to the winds, I suspect.
Yeah, and it's so cavalier to hold people indefinitely without charge and not even have a decent goddamn file on them. Okay.
Yeah, well, no, absolutely.
that's inhuman and inexcusable. But let me get your reaction to this admission from Obama and couple it with the departure of Greg Craig, the White House counsel, who had been put in charge of closing Gitmo. And he departed the administration on the day when Obama was distracting everybody by flying to China, or to Asia, actually.
Yeah, well, I think that Greg Craig was scapegoated, and, you know, and I think that's been rather depressing because, you know, there was a period about, it must have been about 6 weeks ago when one of the major papers focused on this story, and it seemed to have been fed information from inside the administration trying to blame him for everything. You know, that it's his fault for setting an unrealistic deadline. And in fact, there was a great quote from Robert Gates, who, you know, I don't often find myself in enormous sympathy with.
Yes.
He's a Republican running the Pentagon for a Democrat president. What's that about?
And I share your concern.
You know, he got it dead right. He said, look, you know, if you know Washington, nothing's going to happen without a deadline. Of course it made sense to impose a deadline on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I thought that was dead right. So, you know, this talk of the administration backing off is just, you know, another demonstration of cowardice to some extent, I think. But it's a real problem, I think. And, you know, what really shocked me, President Obama admitting this openly, was that it's closed all the possible doors now to persuade Congress. Now, I mean, admittedly, this may have been impossible, but any final attempt to persuade Congress before this deadline, you know, we really need to do this, you know, to try and stress to the lawmakers, because, you know, they can have a majority and have recently, in the face of some rather mad moves by Republicans, again, demonstrated that they can have a majority to overturn questions related to Guantanamo. But he could have pushed for saying, look, let's do this. We're going to put them somewhere very secure in the United States, and then we can carry on this procedure of dealing with them. We have to remove this stain on our nation, you know, that is such a black name for us abroad. And now that he's let the deadline slip, how on earth is he going to manage to persuade anybody to impose another deadline or actually seriously to do anything about all the people that are held at Guantanamo who he can't bring to the U.S. mainland? And let's not forget that all he managed to secure from Congress after all this wrangling throughout this year was that he can only bring to the U.S. mainland those prisoners who will face a trial. He announced these 10 last week, and officials have been saying off the record that the maximum that are going to be charged is about 40. This leaves 175 men in Guantanamo. Now, the day after the deadline elapses, how do they get out of there? Do they stay there for a year, for 2 years, for the rest of their lives? It seems to me the time for some big questions about what happens to those people needs to start being asked now. But, you know,
Andy, let me just interject here and ask you to educate me a little bit, because I don't want to oversimplify it, but at the same time, I don't want to overcomplicate the set of issues here. Of those remaining, after what you just alluded to, 40 are charged and brought to trial in the United States, 175 people who don't rise to the level of a full prosecution, then to me it's a simple case. They are either charged and pursued through military commissions, which I don't support, but that's one route that Obama continues to hold open, and there are plans for some of these people to be put through that system. But in simple terms, charge them, try them, hold those who are convicted, and everyone else must be released. It's simple and cut and dried. What am I missing?
You tell me what you're missing. I mean, you know, of these other people who he can't bring to the mainland and who I think he now, you know, has cut off his escape route, half of these guys, Peter, have been cleared for release. Many of them, the majority of them, in fact, were cleared by military review boards under the Bush administration. Some of them have been released after the courts reviewed their habeas corpus petitions. They've all been cleared for release after Obama's interagency task force, this rather dawdling task force that was reviewing the cases this year, reached its conclusions. So, you know, the big problem for these guys is that the route that would have been, I think, acceptable to the whole of the world, which is that some of these men would have been settled in the U.S. because no other country would take them, was cut off. It was cut off by Congress, but it was also partly cut off by cowardice on the part of the Obama administration.
Right.
Now, Europe has taken, so far, whatever it is, you know, less than 10 of these men. And it's clear that, you know, that America's allies around the world are not going to be able to step up and take 50 or 60 of these guys. They're just not. I mean, you know, Obama's lucky that countries in Europe are getting beyond the first question, which is, why are we doing this when you're not doing anything?
Yeah.
You know, that's the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's half of them. The other half, yes, these are the people who... Obama hasn't stated this explicitly, but his officials, you know, said it to the Washington Post a few days ago, that these are people who can't be charged because the evidence against them, you know, there isn't enough evidence against them. And really what the story is here is that these are people that they regard as dangerous, but the evidence against them is tainted because they don't actually have what you or I would call evidence. What they have are, you know, a bunch of allegations that were derived through torture. And they should really give up on this one. And what amazes me is the kind of effrontery of these officials to be leaking this kind of information when there is a route in which this can be cleared up, and that is to allow and, in fact, to facilitate the habeas corpus petitions of these men to proceed through the district courts, where, for the last year, judges have been looking at exactly these kind of issues.
Mm-hmm.
And in, you know, over 80% of them, in 30 out of 38 cases, have judged that it's not a case of these men being too dangerous to release and that there isn't enough evidence. They have judged that the basis of the evidence is completely flawed, that it does not justify holding these people, because it isn't evidence. What it is a collection of allegations made by other prisoners under unknown circumstances, but that may have involved torture or duress, or that may have involved bribery in many cases, and the judges have been swapping notes, and they've been finding that the same guys in Guantanamo have been making allegations against a vast number of prisoners, and that all these people are unreliable. You know, and so they don't really have evidence against most of these men, because if we go back to the beginning, which was where they rounded people up for bounty payments, most of them were caught by Afghan and Pakistani allies, they didn't know who they had. Everything they have on these prisoners, for the most part, has been built up since they were captured.
Well,
years of, you know, abusive conditions.
And we have the legacy of the House of Mirrors that is created when you torture people, and they will repeat what you tell them. They'll say anything to get you to stop. And so that creates a body of phony evidence that is then used. You take inmate A and get him to squawk on inmate B, and then you go to B, and you say, look what he said about you. And all of this is pure fiction, and, you know, it's a house of cards that cannot stand. Yet we want to pretend that because they've been held at Guantanamo, that they are guilty of something, and therefore we have to, you know, cower in fear that they could be released. And the biggest thing we need to be afraid of is that we took innocent men and radicalized them against the United States by holding them under these barbaric conditions and terms.
Well, absolutely, yeah. You know, and that's been one of the ludicrous things that the administration has admitted in the case of the Yemenis. You know, the Yemenis make up nearly half of the remaining prisoners. And President Bush was always worried about letting any of them go because the Yemen is, you know, is too lawless for them to have felt safe that they would be released back into an environment where they wouldn't perhaps take up arms, having been, you know, radicalized by their experiences of the abuse that you were talking about. Now, the Obama administration's task force has continued clearing Yemenis. The last count, it was 26. I think they've probably cleared some more of them now. But they've said that they don't want to release any of them unless there is a rehabilitation program in place, that they can go from Guantanamo to a rehabilitation program. So they don't actually want to release them outright and just say, have your freedom, guys. We're sorry about this. What's the difference? Why clear people if you're not going to release them? Why clear people when, you know, you want to impose so many strings that it appears that there's no way that you're going to let these guys go? It just strikes me as ridiculous. And it seems to me another aspect of the terrible threat level that's attached to the whole notion of Guantanamo and the terrorists and the worst of the worst, and that we can't really shake off all this nonsense that was so successfully and cynically promoted by Cheney and Rumsfeld and you know, and their colleagues all those long years ago.
We're talking with journalist Andy Worthington, the author of The Guantanamo Files, and he is the filmmaker and a major presenter in the new documentary Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. Andy, next I want to turn to the decision by the administration to not only make the move, but to announce it at this time, that they are going to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and 5 to 10 other inmates at Guantanamo in federal court in New York City, just a few blocks from the World Trade Center site. And this, there are a couple of elements to it here, and so I'd like to parse it. Number one, I give the administration credit for following through on this and not allowing the naysayers in the Democratic Party and the obstructionists in the Republican Party to win the day. And what we're seeing in the reaction, at least the early reaction from the U.S. Senate, is that Democrats have fallen into line behind the president and are not sniping on this issue the way they were just 6 months ago. So I see that as some progress. At the same time, both the president and the attorney general made remarks, which I consider serious blunders, that undermine the credibility of the process that they have just, at some risk, embarked on, a political risk at minimum. And that is that Obama said that he's confident that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed will be convicted and executed. He amended the comment immediately to say that he wasn't going to be in the courtroom and that he'd leave it to the judge and jury, but he didn't retract his statement of confidence. Likewise, the attorney general, under grilling from members of the U.S. Senate, said that he was fully confident that he, you know, that this trial would go forward, that KSM wouldn't be permitted to grandstand, and that at the end of it, that there would be a conviction and an execution. Now, Holder's a prosecutor, and in some ways you can forgive commentary of that sort, and it's also a little understandable under the circumstances because he's trying to get Lindsey Graham and some of these other right-wing Republicans to sit down and shut up.
Yeah.
But I'm very troubled by the twin representations that we're going to bring these guys to justice, and we know the outcome already.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a fantastic little analysis there, actually, Peter, because, you know, what's driving this in one sense, as you say, is you know, they're up against the wall with all this insane hostility towards them, and they've got to keep demonstrating over and over again, nobody's at risk. You know, we know what we're doing. These are the bad guys. We'll have a proper trial. Now, tagging on at the end, you know, conviction is assured, is unfortunately, I think, indicative of the way that they've been analyzing how they're going to prosecute the cases that they proceed with. And, you know, to tie that in with what else happened, that they, you know, they put these five guys forward for federal court trials, but they've put another five prisoners forward for military commission. And to tie that in again with what we have with these other prisoners who number, you know, according to the administration officials, around 75, who won't face trial but who they don't want to release. We've got three tiers of justice here. And in fact, you know, almost three tiers of compromised justice. The one at the top looks the most credible because it's federal court trials. And in fact, you know, that is the right thing to do. I'm sure they have the evidence. Nobody knows what is going to come out in that courtroom, despite, you know, obviously they won't accept any evidence that was obtained through torture. But nobody knows quite what's going to happen, and that's quite brave. So it's the right thing to do. But they've kind of worked out that they think they're going to get the result. Now, if they think they can't get the result because they've got less evidence or there's more problem with torture, then they've got the military commissions, and that seems to me exactly what they've done, even though they've attempted to disguise it as saying, oh, no, these are for military-related crimes and not for civilian-related crimes like 9/11 was. And then at the bottom of the heap are the people who, when the evidence is so weak, they don't get a trial at all. And these are the three levels. And, yeah. You know, and it seems really to have been laid out very clearly for anybody, you know, who can stand back from it a bit and look at it objectively. And I'm hearing this quite a lot from the lawyers, you know, both civilian lawyers and lawyers who've taken part in the military commissions. They kind of see through it all. And that's rather troubling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it troubles me more, really, that they've brought back the military commissions, which had a dreadful, discredited history as, you know, Dick Cheney's pet terror trials that would just be designed to convict people, where, you know, where it would be hopelessly one-sided from the beginning, and that's all they were designed for. And they were thrown out by the Supreme Court in 2006, and then Congress brought them back, and then they stumbled from one disaster to another over the last few years. And, you know, and everybody with any intelligence or any knowledge of them has stepped back from them and said, this is not the way to do it. Not only are the crimes they're trying to prosecute invented war crimes, but really, there only is one venue to prosecute these things properly, and that's federal court. So the reason that they're not going for federal court trials for everybody is this kind of cowardice and this presumption that maybe they'll get away with it in a second-tier system that, you know, that will disguise some of their failings. And I just don't think that's right. I think it comes back to what we were talking about, Peter, that, you know, what you were saying. Essentially, if you haven't got enough to charge somebody, let's give up on this and let them go, because this is the basis of how we run a judicial system. And otherwise, we're just back in the territory, amending slightly the awful place that the Bush administration put us. And, you know, and no way can any of us hold our heads up and be proud about the way that we're dealing with it.
And, Andy, the other troubling comment that came from the Attorney General in response to questions about, well, what if Khalid Sheikh Mohammed gets off using a technicality, or, you know, they read him as Miranda rights, and he said, well, we won't release him.
Yeah.
And you know, that just is the fog of Gitmo.
Exactly what the Bush administration used to say.
Yeah. And you know, what's the purpose of a trial if your determination is that this individual could never be found not guilty, could never be acquitted? And that goes to the conversation at Gitmo with one of the courageous attorneys, military lawyers who quit after he was told that we can't have any acquittals here.
That was Colonel Morris Davis, a man who had been a fervent believer in the military commissions and who, you know, absolutely turned. He had that conversation with Jim Haynes. You know, those of us who know the stories of the people involved in implementing torture in the United States under the Bush administration know that Jim Haynes is one of a handful of key characters in that scenario. You know, and Mo Davis resigned on principle the day that he was put under a chain of command below Haynes. It was fantastic. The moment that he was told that, he just handed in his resignation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then 6 months later, he came out with this story of what Haynes had told him: no acquittals. And Haynes, after Morris Davis came out with that story in The Nation, Haynes then retired to spend more time with his family about the day after.
Well, he's spending more time at Chevron. He's the House Counsel there now.
He is, and he's been lucky, I think, so far to avoid having placard-waving citizens outside where he works.
There have actually been a few. There have been a few people that go and wave to him over there at the Chevron headquarters. It's in the east of San Francisco, the East Bay town of San Ramon.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that somebody has been keeping an eye on him, because you know, this is a bigger story of whether one day there'll be any accountability. But I mean,
well,
that's on
the same score, let me
told me.
Yeah, go ahead.
That anecdote you just told me about Eric Holder saying, you know, even if they were somehow to be acquitted, we won't let them go. I mean, that's a shocking thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
Why did he do that? All he needs to say, you know, all he needs to say really is, look, we have evidence against these guys that we believe will demonstrate to the jury that these people are responsible for their crimes. And I have no doubt, really, that if we can produce any evidence in court that will suggest to a rational member of a jury that these men did what they, what we say they did, they will be convicted. That's as far as you need to go. You shouldn't really need to, you know, they shouldn't be crossing lines and saying things like that. That's shocking.
Here's a quote from Secretary of State Clinton, our chief diplomat. My goal is to make sure that the mastermind and the other implementers and designers of this horrific attack on us pay the ultimate penalty for what they did to the United States and to a lot of people whom I know and who I had the pleasure, the honor of representing. She's referring to New Yorkers. Well, she's pandering there, but not quite as badly as the president and the attorney general.
No, that's right. That's right.
Now, Andy, I want to turn now to the film, and I want to commend you for the work you've done here, because I've been following these issues as closely as I can here with the crappy coverage in the United States, and with the help of a stellar Brit named Andy Worthington. But, for example, you brought Tom Wilner to the screen, and he is an attorney who's represented many of those held at Guantanamo. And he had a couple of remarkable statements that he made. One is that everyone who went to Gitmo was tortured. And in the U.S., we still remain in denial that we imagine that maybe a few of the guys were. And Cheney has tried to say that, you know, only KSM and a couple of others were waterboarded. But you, in your coverage and the commentary of Wilner, refute that in the strongest possible way.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I think actually, you know, I usually focus on Guantanamo and say that within the context of Guantanamo, you know, the things that we know of as torture techniques, so, you know, prolonged isolation, nudity, the use of stress positions, you know, sleep deprivation that sometimes went on for months,
mm-hmm.
sexual humiliation, the use of dogs, the use of loud music and noise, all of these things, you know, I base my analysis of that on stories from, you know, a number of released prisoners. I mean, nearly everybody who was a European this happened to, and many other released prisoners, but also from a comment that was made by somebody who'd worked there several years ago who said that it applied to one in six of the prisoners. And these are the proper torture techniques. I mean, they really are. This is the equivalent of the package of torture techniques that was used, you know, more seriously, but the same techniques, really, that was used on Mohammed al-Qahtani, the supposed 20th hijacker. You know, and he was supposed to be put forward for a trial, but in the end, the woman, the judge who oversees this process, who makes the final decisions, Susan Crawford, she did this extraordinary interview with Bob Woodward just a couple of weeks before Bush left office, saying, "We tortured Mohammed al-Qahtani." In isolation, each of these techniques didn't amount to torture, but they were actually all practiced together, and that crossed the line. It was the most extraordinary interview that she made.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think that on that basis of what she said, now this is the woman who oversees the Military Commission. She's a friend of Dick Cheney and David Addington. I don't know whether she was covering her back just before, you know, the regime changed. But I think that this applies, the same terminology applies to these other guys, that 100 prisoners or more were essentially a version of the same thing happened to them. And what Tom was talking about in particular was that essentially, if this didn't happen to prisoners in Guantanamo, everybody was subjected to horrible abuse in Afghan custody before they got to Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's absolutely right. I think the... I think it was much more kind of designed and directed in Guantanamo, in that systems were put in place, and then essentially sociopaths were put into rooms with people and told to use their imagination, which was horrible.
Mm-hmm.
But it was kind of directed. I think that it was just part of the fabric of detention in Afghanistan, that they were treating, you know, abominably these people, you know, and we know why, really. What was the basis of their detention? Everybody is guilty. There will be no review process on capture or at any point afterwards, if the administration had had its way, to determine whether or not we did in fact get the bad guys or whether we'd made the most colossal mistakes along the way. And, you know, that's still the message I'm trying to get out.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Andy, one of the other comments that really stuck with me from Tom Wilner, the attorney, This is in the sequence of the film where he's one of the first lawyers to visit Guantanamo in December of 2004. And he comments that he's shocked by the lack of evidence, that the individuals are so thin, they're all shackled to the floor. And then he goes to interview one of the people who he hopes to represent, a prospective client. And the guy says to him, well, you're the fourth person who's come here saying you're my lawyer. And you point out that this is the very first time that lawyers were permitted at Guantanamo. And so we must deduce from that that psychological operations were used against these detainees, where people who were pretending to be lawyers were brought in to meet with them in order to fraudulently try to get them to cough up some information. And this demonstrates to me that there really was no limit whatsoever to the lawlessness and barbarism that we applied.
No, absolutely. I agree with you. And, you know, one of the other things that happened this was reported by the FBI, but that certain operatives within Guantanamo, they weren't CIA. They were part of the kind of most unprincipled bunch of Defense Department interrogators, were impersonating FBI agents. And the FBI was, you know, understandably, was absolutely livid about it.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. I mean, you know, they didn't care. There were really no limits set. But when you look at the palette of things that were available to these interrogators to do, you know, they're pumped up with the rhetoric. They were watching 24. They were getting ideas from it. We know that from insiders. Who's responsible overall for it? It starts to resemble the Abu Ghraib situation. It starts to resemble the bad apple scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, that's just patently false.
Yeah.
What's happening is that people who are used to taking orders are told, first of all, these people have no rights, and secondly, are then told to kind of get creative with them and are handed down a number of things that might be useful for them to do. This is where we're still looking, I think, Peter, is that, you know, some of us from Abu Ghraib onwards have been looking up the chain of command and wondering when those people will be held accountable.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly we're getting no comfort from the current administration that they intend to do that. But those of us who are concerned about justice, who are concerned about fairness, who are concerned about right and wrong, we can't rest really until these questions have been addressed.
Mm-hmm.
It was the leaders of the United States under the Bush administration who implemented all of these disgraceful things that we're talking about.
Now, Andy, in the film, you present the cases of a number of individuals. Many Americans are familiar with Binyam Mohammed, partly because he has been a plaintiff in a case that got some publicity earlier this year, in the very beginning of 2009. You also focus a lot on Omar Dagayez. I also want to talk a little bit about Shaker Amer. But one of the things that is a common thread is that these individuals were doing charity work. They went to Afghanistan to build clean water supplies, to open schools. Some of them were just on vacation and taking cash to distribute, to help people buy food or clothing or whatever their fundamental needs were. And so these were the equivalent of Mormon missionaries or Christian missionaries who went there to try to help people. And it just adds an extra twist of ugliness and darkness to their ultimate detention, incarceration without charge, the torture that was visited on these people who were there out of nearly altruistic influences.
Well, no, absolutely. And, I mean, it's once you start to get into the actual stories of the prisoners that you realize that because they weren't screened on capture, because there were no Article 5 competent tribunals under the Geneva Conventions, which, you know, the U.S. military had pioneered from Vietnam onwards, where when the people you capture aren't wearing uniforms, you hold these tribunals close to the time and place of capture and attempt to assess their stories, and if there are witnesses that can be reasonably called, then they're called. And, you know, where this came from, principally the office of the vice president of Cheney and Addington deciding, wouldn't it be great if we just decide that on capture everybody's guilty and there's no way of reviewing it? It was never looked at. And of course, it's deeply shocking then to realize that what happened to these guys is that they then get sent to Guantanamo. You know, they're humanitarian aid workers, let's say, as so many of them were. I mean, really, you know, dozens and dozens of these men were.
Mm-hmm.
And they're then asked questions about, you know, the workings of Al-Qaeda and where is Osama bin Laden, and they don't know the answers. And instead of this being accepted by the people who are interrogating them and the people who are directing these procedures, they say, oh, we found this Al-Qaeda training manual that told these guys how to resist interrogation. So that's clearly what we're up against. These people are being deliberately obstructive because that's what these clever terrorists do. So, you know, we're going to have to break these people. You know, and what happens then? Well, then they start the enhanced interrogation techniques on them. I mean, that's about as bleak as it gets, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You end up torturing innocent people because you don't believe they're innocent. To me, it's like the witch hunt, is that you can't, you know, if you say you're innocent, there's no way that you can be believed.
Mm-hmm. Now, specific to Binyam Muhammad, I referenced his case here it was before a federal court in California, and the Obama administration in February shocked us all by stepping in to assert that the suit could not go forward in any way, shape, or manner because of the assertion of state secrets. And this is a case where the Obama administration not only embraced the bad legal precedents established under Bush, but tried to extend them. And recently, a British court ruled in favor of Mr. Mohammed, saying that the British government must disclose the American intelligence related to the torture that he experienced at Guantanamo. And they ruled that seven paragraphs that had been removed from material that were released previously should be made public. What's the significance of this ruling, Andy?
The British ruling?
Yes.
Well, you know, this has been going on since last August, Peter, when you know, judges in the UK had finally got hold of Binyam's case through some innovative work by his lawyers in the UK, and they came to rule on it, and they were appalled that suddenly they discovered this whole world of extraordinary rendition and torture, and of British complicity in it. So, you know, they delivered a judgment which was, you know, the case was specifically about releasing these documents to his lawyers, because at the time, Binyam Muhammad had been put forward for trial by a military commission, and it was possible that he was going to face the death penalty. And they said, you know, look, we need access to material to mount a defense for this man who's a British resident, and here's the British government withholding evidence that came from the Americans, but that is useful to us. And the judges agreed. But the government, you know, the British government then stepped in and said, no, you can't. You know, it would wreck our intelligence-sharing relationship with the United States were you to do this. And the case has rolled on and on. And, you know, in fact, the latest seems to be that, you know, they were threatened. The relationship, you know, threats were made under the Bush administration. But those threats have not been repeated by Obama administration officials. What we're now left with is the British government desperately pretending that this is the case,
mm-hmm.
whereas it's not. But, you know, this information has still not been revealed. It was the judges writing a short summary of an American intelligence report about what had happened to Binyam Muhammad in Pakistani custody when U.S. agents were interrogating him, and very possibly, you know, what their plans were, which was then to send him to Morocco, where he spent 18 months being tortured. And the British government's desperate to keep a lid on everything, because, of course, you know, it will reveal complicity in crimes, in war crimes. You know, with the Jeppesen case, which Binyam Muhammad was involved in, the case in California where the government,
that's the travel agency that arranged the rendition flights, and it's
right.
A division of Boeing.
Now, you know, I have to say, Peter, that on two levels I can understand why the Obama administration did that. One, you know, it's a subsidiary of Boeing. Subsidiary of a large American corporation. You know, would I expect the government to allow that to proceed? Well, no, I wouldn't. And the other aspect of what the case was that it was against the agents who were involved. And on that level, I would say, okay, I don't mind if you don't want to prosecute the individual guys who are following orders. But what we all need you to do is that we need you to go against the people who gave them those orders.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we're going back to accountability and to where we were before, that actually they don't want anybody to be accountability to be accountable. And, you know, I'm not going to stand for that. If you're going to let the little guys go, fine. But the only trade-off for that is that you go after the people who made the orders. Not mm-hmm. that we get this blanket obstruction of any attempt to make anybody accountable at any level.
And that's the disappointment of the convictions in Milan in absentia of the U.S. agents who participated in a rendition there. And I don't know if Italian law would permit the charging of those who ordered the rendition and those who framed the policies.
Right. Well, certainly, I mean, I don't know enough about the case to know whether it would have extended there. My feeling is that, you know, in the case of one of the, maybe it was the station chief, it didn't apply to him. So it seems like there's some kind of convenient cutoff point to prevent it going any higher.
Yeah, yeah, they do have some immunity. And that said, I applaud the Italians for going as far as they did on this case.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's the first court anywhere around the world to, you know, to actually take it to a ruling and to say, you know, I'm sorry, guys, but, you know, what you did was illegal.
mm-hmm.
You know, you can't go around the world kidnapping people off streets in broad daylight, you know, which to me was a sign of how arrogant they were at that point, that, you know, why not just do it at night? You know, why not do it in a way that you didn't get noticed? No, I mean, they must have been so cocky by that point. It's like, mm-hmm. let's go and nab this cleric off the streets, guys. No, you can't do that. These are criminal activities. And I'm very glad that they made that ruling. But as you say, you know, does it have a bigger impact? I think what it's done is that, you know, it's annoyed operatives within the CIA, but, you know, I doubt that it's shaken those above them
mm-hmm.
and people who were involved in the decision-making process. Yet again, you know, they seem to be getting away with it.
Andy, in your documentary, Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo, one of the cases you present that really struck a chord with me is Shaker Amer. And repronounce that if I got it wrong. But he, as you describe him, was a guy who seemed indomitable despite the torture and the whole regime that was imposed on him. He became a kind of unofficial leader of those held at Guantanamo. And as he was described by others who were held there, he was the guy who could come into the room or into the cage, I guess, and have a smile on his face and crack you up even under the darkest circumstances. Tell us about Shaker and what we know about his current status.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, Shaker Amer was somebody who traveled to Afghanistan with Mirzam Beg, you know, the very well-known released British prisoner who, mm-hmm. who you know, has written a book about his experiences, is also in the film, you know, and is and now the
And let's just reference his
group here.
His website is cageprisoners.com.
That's right.
There's some great information there. Go ahead.
Yeah, and, you know, so, you know, they both were captured separately after, you know, after chaos descended on Afghanistan, and Mozam had actually made it to Pakistan and was reunited with his family and then was kidnapped from his villa in the middle of the night, kind of like Omar the Guy, except it happened to him in the daytime. Shaker was captured, nobody seems quite sure, but we think in Afghanistan, that he was sold for a bounty to U.S. forces. And that from the very beginning, this was a man who was fantastically eloquent and charismatic, spoke perfect English, and would not accept the injustice against him. So he started a hunger strike right at the beginning in Kandahar, one of the prisons in Afghanistan, before he got to Guantanamo. And in Guantanamo, he became this, you know, effectively, you know, somebody who was regarded as a leader by the prisoners then, partly because he spoke English and could speak to the authorities, but, you know, simply because of his personality. And as a result, he was regarded as a senior Al-Qaeda leader. And you know, he at one point in the summer of 2005, when there was a very big hunger strike in Guantanamo, there was a strange period when there was a prisoners' council that was allowed to happen, as though the Geneva Conventions applied. And it looked for a moment as though the Geneva Conventions were actually going to be introduced. And then the people higher up, you know, ruled this out. The whole thing collapsed, and Shaka was put in solitary. And he was held in complete solitary confinement for, I believe, for about 3 years. And I believe that he is now held in what is not technically strict solitary confinement, but is held in Camp 5. And these are solid wall cells where the prisoners spend all their time alone, apart from a small amount of time in an exercise yard alone.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a block of solitary confinement cells. So, you know, that was the clampdown on him from that time. His punishment for being somebody who stood up for the rights of the prisoners was that.
And you also pointed out that speaking English well was a liability.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, these were the people who could communicate with the authorities. So I think depending on, you know, on what your personality was, you could speak English and you could actually have, you know, develop a working relationship with the guards. I mean, that's what happened in Mozam's case. He was held in solitary a lot, but he was always trying to strike up conversations with the people who were there to guard him, and he developed some relationships with people that way.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're Shaka Armour and you speak English and you're constantly challenging the authorities because you don't approve, you can't stand the way that the prisoners are being treated, then you get to be regarded as a threat. And you get to be regarded as much more of a threat than a guy who could be saying all kinds of things in Arabic, but you don't know what they're saying because you don't speak Arabic.
Mm-hmm. And Andy, by the way, thank you for your time. We've gone much longer than I had expected today, but it's a great conversation. We've covered a lot of interesting things and recent developments. In closing, I wanted to ask you if you could confirm something that I learned recently. And before I get to that, can I just ask if you've ever seen the American classic film, The Wizard of Oz?
I have, yeah.
Okay. And you know, when Dorothy finally gets there to the Emerald City and gets into the complex there, the last-ditch effort of the wizard, he says, "Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain."
Yes.
Okay. And I use that as a metaphor for what's going on as Obama very publicly tries to close Guantanamo. And we've, you know, acknowledged the struggles and the political pushback that has occurred. But what's truly significant is that we continue the Guantanamo concept on a much larger scale at the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. And yesterday, I was talking with Pepe Escobar, who is an international globe-trotting reporter, and he has been to Afghanistan over the last 5 years and covered it for the Asian Times. He publishes
sure.
that online. And he said to me that there are now 10,000 individuals being held at Bagram. And the highest number I had heard, Andy, up to just a couple of months ago, was less than 1,000.
Yeah.
And I'm still troubled by it because the Gitmo rules are in effect. It's no charges, indefinite. And while they want us to believe that many of these people were picked up on the quote-unquote battlefield in Afghanistan, they've acknowledged that the bulk of those being held at Bagram were shipped in from somewhere else. So does it make any sense, and is it morally right to put all this attention into the effort to close Guantanamo when our barbaric tactics continue unabated at Bagram? And can you confirm the 10,000 number?
Well, I can't actually, no. And I mean, as far as I was aware, that, you know, they've just revamped it and it will hold about 1,500. So I don't know where that story comes from.
Okay.
But and also, you know, the majority of the prisoners that are held in Bagram are Afghans. Now, you know, and there is a smaller number, we think it's about 30, that seems to be regularly cited, who are foreign prisoners who were transferred into Bagram after being caught somewhere else. And some of them have been there now for 6 or 7 years.
Mm-hmm. And that number is in two digits? That's 30 or so?
Yeah, I mean, that's,
okay,
that's regularly cited. I mean, to be honest, do we know absolutely? Well, no, we don't, because they refuse to release any information
mm-hmm.
about who's actually held there. You know, to compare that to Guantanamo would be the situation as it was in early 2006. It was the spring of 2006 before a number of newspapers and organizations won a lawsuit to force the Pentagon to release that information. Maybe the ACLU will finally get there with that and we'll know. But yeah, there's secrecy. There is a prison that has not been run according to the Geneva Conventions for prisoners of war,
mm-hmm.
and that still doesn't seem to be, even though the administration is attempting to introduce something that resembles screening on capture for people who will be held in future. You know, it's not the right way to be doing things at all. It appears to be continuing the Bush administration's unilateral rewriting of the Geneva Conventions. Now, okay, if they want to do that, fine. But if a non-uniformed American, you know, soldier or member of the military personnel of some kind, not in uniform, is captured by enemy forces somewhere, and they hold them in that way that they, you know, hold them for an undefined amount of time, may give them some review at some point, may release them, may not, the Americans would be up in arms.
Sure.
Because they would expect people to be treated as prisoners of war. Now, the foreigners who were rendered there, that's a troubling story because, you know, enterprising lawyers managed to find out who some of them were and filed habeas corpus petitions on their behalf. Now, in April, in a district court, Judge John Bates ruled that the habeas rights that were extended by the Supreme Court to the Guantanamo prisoners applied to these foreigners who were rendered to Bagram, because he said they were essentially the same as the Guantanamo prisoners. And I agree with him. I can see absolutely no reason why this is not the case. And yet, the Obama administration appealed. Now, why is that? I can only suspect that it's because they're holding a corner of Bagram outside the law that doesn't conform at all to the Geneva Conventions, where they, you know, have their own little version of the Bush administration detention policy still going on, because somebody, and if it's not senior administration officials, it's the Pentagon and the intelligence services, are really happy with this new way of doing things that was developed after 2001
mm-hmm.
and want to carry on doing it. So, you know, all is not right there, and I think we should be worried. I'm not convinced of the scale of it, and the direct comparisons to Bush's Guantanamo are appropriate, but it's certainly something that needs to be scrutinized.
Mm-hmm.
And I will just say as well, if I may, that what I've been worried by that I've read in the last few days is that one of the possibilities for some of the guys at Guantanamo that they don't want to charge, and that they think they have something against, and it's in a military context, is that all these years after failing screen them to find out whether they were combatants, after all these years after failing to hold them as prisoners of war, I've been hearing some rumors recently that maybe they could move some of these guys to Bagram and hold them there in this kind of quasi prisoner of war situation until the spectral end of hostilities. And, you know, will that ever happen? And I don't know whether that's legal or appropriate, but something to me chills me really that,
mm-hmm.
that after all this time we can be having these discussions about, oh, maybe that's the way to sort this out is to move them, ship them off to Afghanistan and put them in somewhere that doesn't even have the limited history of accountability that Guantanamo has. It just seems very wrong to me.
Yeah. Well, Andy, thank you again for your time today. Thanks for your work on these important issues. Andy Worthington's website is andyworthington.co.uk, and his book is entitled The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. And once again, the new documentary is called Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. And any excerpts of the video available yet online somewhere, Andy?
We're hoping to get something sorted out next week, actually, Peter, that will be available on YouTube and that we'll then be able to start publicizing it. And we're also intending to get DVDs on sale very soon, so people can either visit my website or they can visit the production company's website, which is Spectacle Productions. And I would also just like to say that the film was co-directed with Polly Nash, who wasn't able to visit the States with me last week, but that, you know, none of this would have been possible without her as well.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Well, thank you, sir, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you, Peter. I think it's been a particularly fascinating conversation this evening. Thanks again.
I sure agree. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Your feedback is welcome. Email me, peter@peterbcollins.com. Happy trails.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.